Hello and welcome. You're listening to Fourth Estate, the show where journalists talk journalism. Coming to you from 2SER in Sydney on the Gadigal lands of the Eora Nation, right across Australia on the Community Radio Network, and directly to your device across the globe via podcast. My name is Peter Frey. I'm the co-director of the Centre for Media Transition at the University of Technology, Sydney, and my producer is Anthony Dockrell. A very big thank you to him as ever. Tonight, we are going to look at one of the most interesting and arguably most important pieces of journalism of the past 12 months and talk to the journalists behind it. A few weeks ago, I had the privilege of talking to Hedley Thomas about his podcast, Teacher's Pet. And now I have the equally great privilege of exploring Exposed, the story of Kelly Lane with Caro Meldrum Hanna. Hello, Caro.
Hello. Thank you for having me. It's been a long time coming.
I'm sure it's going to be worth the wait.
I hope so.
I'm sure. Mm. This is a cracking yarn. I mean, it's got everything. It's got babies. It's got dark secrets. It's got a crime, missing person, presumed dead. Just for the benefit of for the handful of people who haven't really caught up with the story, tell us about it in essence and maybe then reflect on what makes it such a great story.
Yeah, sure. At the centre of it all is a woman called Kelly Lane. She is from Sydney's affluent northern beaches. She was known as the Golden Girl, actually. Coming from Manly, she was a very talented athlete. Mm. She was a swimmer. She was a water polo player. She was a great runner. She had a huge amount of friends, very popular, very attractive. Blonde hair, tan skin. She was really sort of the girl that had it all.
And vivacious.
She was vivacious, confident. She was going somewhere in life. Mm-hmm. Her father was the local cop and her mum worked at the local hospital and they were very well known and very respected. So, you know, outwardly, Kelly Lane was a bit of a star.
She had it all.
She did.
Yeah, the Aussie dream.
Inside, she was deeply troubled. Mm. She had a double life, really. A lot of secrets and a lot of lies. And this all centered around really falling pregnant. Mm. She fell pregnant repeatedly 6 times. By the time she was 23 or 24, she had 2 terminations for the first. Her first pregnancy was when she was in year 12 at school. She terminated that one then a second soon after. But when she fell pregnant a third time, she took a radically different path and she didn't terminate the pregnancy. Instead, she kept it. She was playing elite water polo. She concealed the pregnancy all the way. Had the baby in secret, didn't tell anyone. No one asked her a thing, despite her changing body shape.
That's remarkable.
Remarkable we'll get to that, in itself. That, just
yeah,
one.
Remarkable.
She did it again and again. 3 babies within 5 years, all in secret. No one knew. The dads didn't know. And she adopted the first and the third out. But the middle child, Tegan, a girl, she went missing when she was just 2 days old. Two days old and the day Kelly Lane left hospital with her out in Western Sydney.
And went to a wedding.
She went to a wedding. That's right. She turned up a couple of hours later in a white suit, crisp white suit. And for anyone who's had a child, they would know how outrageously strange in itself just that is, a woman turning up in a white suit. And on top of that, Kelly Lane, it had been a difficult birth actually with Tegan. She'd hemorrhaged significantly. And she'd lost a lot of blood too. She had manual removal of the placenta, which is a pretty, you know, ferocious and a very painful thing. So she wasn't certainly she wouldn't have been feeling her best. And she was in a white suit. There she was at the wedding and dancing away and went home. An incredible physical and psychological feat to do that. And at the centre of it all really is this woman. I mean, who is this woman, enigma? Who could do this possibly? But also it's where is that baby?
Of course.
We know where the other two
are. That's the mystery.
And she's sitting in jail now, Kelly Lane. She's been sitting in there for around 8 years.
Yes.
Convicted of murder, of murdering Tegan.
Without a body.
Without a body. Body's never been found. There were no witnesses, no forensic sort of evidence, no blood, no weapon. There's no body. And it's this big black hole, these hours when Kelly Lane left hospital and when she turned up at her parents' place and then went on to the wedding. What happened there?
And that's what you've been seeking to fill in.
Indeed, because despite a coronial inquest, a very high-profile murder trial and a very controversial murder trial, that is still a mystery. No one has established what on earth happened in those hours. Now, obviously, the prosecution successfully argued that Kelly Lane, in some unknown way, at some unknown location at a rather unknown time, killed and disposed of Tegan, Kelly Lane says, I didn't kill my baby. I gave it away to its biological father and this man who has never been found.
Who's got two names.
He's got two names. He had two names. Yeah, from Andrew Morris to an Andrew Norris, M to an N. And now in our program at the end of the series, she relented for the first time in so, so many years and said, I don't even think that surname's right. I'm withdrawing the surname and all I can give you is Andrew. It seems that she clung on to a surname where she explains when she was under a huge amount of stress and in her feeling the duress with police when she was being interrogated without any representation, I would add, in her three police interviews. So it's a really complex tale, and we were dealing with the character at the center of it, someone who is known to have been a serial liar.
Absolutely.
So how are we going to unpick, number one, all of those lies from the past, but then find a way to deal with what she was telling us now and figure out if that was the truth or not?
So, yeah, what's great about your – I mean, so many great things about what you've done, but one of them is it's very transparent. I mean, we're on a journey with you. We see you get the, you know, essentially first contact with Kelly.
Mm.
What did you make of that? You know, you get hit up with lots of great story ideas. Mm. You've done some amazing stories. So what was it that you went, oh, Kelly Lane? Because Kelly Lane's story, even though it's a mystery, has been told many times.
That's it, like Lynn Dawson, her disappearance and suspected death has long been reported on. I mean, Hedley Thomas was actually reported on it himself.
Yes. So Kelly Lane contacted you, right?
Indeed she did. And when all this was in the news, I never reported on it. I never had anything to do with the Kelly Lane matter, say, unlike Hedley Thomas. Mm. I was at university when it was all happening.
Mm.
So I had no professional or personal connection to it. And to be quite frank, not a lot of interest in it. It was something that happened sort of before my time as a journalist, really.
Mm.
So I was sitting in the office at Four Corners, where I was at the ABC as a reporter, and I received a letter, just like every day people write to you and asking you to look at their stories. Some are letters from lunatics, and you can tell straight away.
Mm-hmm. Red pen, green pen.
Whatever colour or whatever font it's in.
That's a tip for anyone out there who wants to send a letter to a journal. Don't send it in green or red. Anyway.
Indeed. But I opened this one up, and it was the most perfectly written, neat, well composed letter I'd ever received. And as I was reading along, and my heart started to race harder and harder, because I was thinking this can only be from one person, and then it was from Kelly Lane, you know, this notorious child killer. Why is she writing to me? I have no connection to her. She later explained why. She'd been watching my programs, my Four Corners programs in prison, and she said, I turned to my fellow inmate and said, that's the girl for me. She reports without fear or favour is what she was saying.
Yes, no, that's right. That comes across in that first step as well, right?
Yeah. So, but I was conflicted. Mm. At first I thought it was a hoax, this letter. She was asking me to look into her case. She was saying she's innocent, she's tried everything, that her child is out there. She needs to reinvigorate the search for her child. I'll never forget that line. And she wanted to prove that she didn't harm that child, and she certainly didn't kill her baby. But I knew, you know, how on earth were we, the team that came together, going to get further than so many investigators and detectives and coroners and solicitors and lawyers, you know, people versed and so highly skilled in solving these mysteries.
But your gut instinct was telling you something, right?
Big time.
What was it telling you?
Well, secrets and lies.
Yep.
And it was that the truth is still unknown. It was just the truth siren was going off. Truth. Can I solve a mystery here? Because it really is one of the greatest mysteries in a criminal sense of our time, and one of our most controversial cases, how a woman has gone to prison with, on the face of it, what seems like quite a low level there of hard evidence, you know, right down to the fact that when even the coroner and the judge is saying there is actually no proof that the child is even dead, let alone that this woman killed her or caused her death. There is no body. But just because, on the other hand, as the prosecution says, there isn't a body, it doesn't mean a murder hasn't been committed.
Well, that's right. I mean, so, Tegan Lane could be living in the United States, you know, about to graduate or something, right?
Yeah. That's Indeed, she could be. She would be 22 now.
Yeah.
Peter, so yes, where is she? Is she 6 feet under? Is she 2 feet under? Has she been given to someone? Is she living a life someone not knowing who she is?
So I'm going to have to ask that question then. Do you know?
At this point in time?
At this point in time.
I can't say confidently, no, I don't know.
But you have a suspicion?
I do. I have my suspicion, yes.
Would you like to share that with us?
I'm so sorry, no.
You sure?
I would not like
really
to.
Sure?
No, I would not like to at this point in time. There is always a great temptation as a journalist, I think particularly when you get so close to something where it can almost become personal and you can slide into advocacy journalism. And I see that occur sometimes, and it always makes me very uncomfortable because my opinion or my thought is actually really not relevant. It's the facts and what I can actually bulletproof.
Yeah, no, it's an interesting point because,
you know, you can make big calls as a journalist, but they can be wrong. You need to be on solid ground.
And yet in this reporting, in this style of reporting, it is not necessarily your story, but you are central to that story. You're not an anonymous reporter who pops up at the beginning of the show and we see you in the car, we see you interviewing the mother. That was remarkable. So it's very much.
And that was a deliberate
story.
Thing, Peter, yeah. And thank you for picking up on that, because it was a construction that we conceived, myself and the co-creator of this series, Exposed, is what we called it. And it's ideally, and the goal is that this just keeps going Exposed. We come back with a different season, a different topic, a different story. Repeatedly, we come back in different outings and forms and shapes, but we deliberately constructed it in that way to, I guess, rip down this traditional wall that has been between journalist and your audience or viewers or readers. The journalism's changing, and the people who are consuming it, they're changing too, and they want different things. And distrust in the media and what journalists do has never been higher than it is now. There is great distrust for what we do. So I was thinking about this a lot when I was thinking, how are we going to bring something different to Australia than what Australians are used to seeing with long-form journalism, particularly television documentaries? And it's always the sort of voice of God narrator. I wanted to get rid of that too. There's no narration in the program. It's driven by all of the characters, and I myself and co-reporter Elise Worthington become a character in that, deliberately to show the audience the actual process. When I was at Four Corners, I used to receive so much criticism and backlash from people who would say, why didn't you interview that person? Why didn't you try and contact them? Why did you ask that person that question? What have you left out? How did you find that person? How did you get them to say yes? I thought, you know what? Why don't we just show them as much as we can what we do? And avoid all of that distraction from the actual journalism.
Yeah, it's an exercise in transparency.
Yeah, for sure. And a bit of trust. And two, if you're asking your subjects, I think as well as journalist, if you're asking your subjects and your interviewees and your talent, as we call them, I guess crudely in the television industry, if you're asking people to expose themselves all the time, to sit down in front of a camera, I think, let's all do it.
Yeah. No, I'm totally with you on this. And I mean, the other thing that's happening here is the role of the audience in being co-investigators in a way.
I've
lost count of where the Facebook group is at. Last time I looked, it was about 30,000 members.
Yeah,
more than that.
I think so. I think it's nudged over.
And they're helping. They're putting in lots of tips, right? There's lots of flooded with information.
Flooded with information. Lots of tips. Lots of conversation, which is pretty hard to control. And you know, you don't really want to control conversation, but legally you need to, with wild theories and accusations that are baseless. And I think that's fantastic, because the people in this Facebook group, they've come up with ideas, and they have knowledge of searching things and places that we didn't, number one, didn't even think of, but also don't know how to do. There was a moment of realization for me after the Facebook group was set up, which was Flip Pryor at the ABC. Her fantastic idea. It was a bit of a visionary.
What a great idea.
She's a total legend.
Totally.
And it was her idea to start this up, and it was this big realization when these ideas and people were coming through with great stuff. I thought, oh my gosh. Often we journalists, we are so arrogant. We think we can do this all ourselves, or we know best. We really don't for a lot of the time. These people, many of them had better ideas and were cleverer than me. So thank you to the audience, I guess, is all I can say there. And they're things that have legitimately led us to actually close off a few leads. which is great.
Right. Okay. And giving you new leads, right?
That's right.
Lots of new. Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay. Let's go back to the story because there's lots of compelling interviews in this story.
Yeah.
But none
great
more,
cast of characters.
Great cast of characters. None more so than Kelly Lane's mum and dad. Mm. As the show progresses, the interviews with Sandy, the mother, in particular, come fraught. I'm not sure if that's the right word. They become raw intense. There's a lot of
very
raw
tense.
Emotion in there.
Very tense. Yeah, you're right. I have never ever been in someone's house where the mood, it's hard to describe, where the mood and the atmosphere was so heavy. The first day we got there, and they were really, really super nervous and anxious. I mean, this has been a disaster for them. Their lives have been blown up from the inside out. Mm-hmm. And we're sitting in there, sitting down with a mother and a father who are going on camera and talking about their daughter who is sitting in prison for murdering their granddaughter. Mm. And around us are photos of little gorgeous Kelly Lane with medals hung around her neck at nippers. Mm. This beautiful child who they adore, and they're there sitting talking about that. A great failing in parenting, in their connection and relationship with her, you know, so much there, so much distress and sorrow. So they were very hard to manage, and they are both extremely distrustful, almost to the point of hateful of the media. They suffered terribly being mobbed and chased down the street. So when we're in there and they finally agreed to talk to us, I just said to them, look, we've got to treat this as just an armchair chat. I'm not here to interrogate you. We're not in court. Mm-hmm. I want to know about your daughter. I want to know about what led to this, and I want to know about your involvement. Let's try and understand her, because I don't think we understand Kelly Lane, because she's never, ever spoken, you see, and you two really haven't either. So, but they're interesting characters in themselves, and what you would normally expect, I guess, from a mother, from Sandy, say, I think the audience would have been expecting her to break down in tears immediately.
Mm. Far from it in this case, though, wasn't it?
It was the exact opposite.
Yeah.
She was tough. Mm. She was cool. She was disconnected from it. She was actually quite ignorant of many of the facts involved in the matter. I got to a point where I was telling her things, basic facts about
Kelly
Lane's
movements.
No, I saw that. But
did you believe that?
I did.
You see her as it were, a credible witness, as it were.
I believed her lack of knowledge on several things. I do, but a point. But when it really comes down to whether she knew Kelly Lane was pregnant or not, to me it was more a case of I'm not seeing something because I don't want to see it, rather than I haven't seen it. Mm. If she opened up her eyes a little bit more. But look, you can only ask someone the question over and over. It's their answer that you have to be guided by. That I can't tell her, you know, what you believe is wrong. It's what she believes. She believes that she didn't know she was pregnant. Others believe that Sandy Lane did know Kelly Lane was pregnant. But we asked Sandy, and she said what she said. Mm. But they were, look, they were very, very difficult interviews because they were so reluctant. But by the end, it was actually quite a, you know, fascinating evolution. It went from this really tense and hostile environment to actually, at the final interview, and the interviews ran over several months. Mm-hmm. We were in that house for hours and hours and hours every time. And on the final interview, I won't forget it, Sandy Lane, she broke down in tears, and she said, and I didn't expect this, she got up out of a chair and she hugged me and she said, thank you. And I think Sandy got to a point that she hadn't reached before. She was just, she could openly weep about it. She sort of let down a guard. It was just, ugh.
This is journalism as therapy almost, isn't it?
Perhaps. Sometimes it can be cathartic for people if you give them the time. You give them the time and the understanding and the compassion and just listen.
What's going on in your head at this point? In all these interviews, what's going on in your head? At one level you're going, I'm assuming, I've got to get the story.
I'm on the hunt. Yeah.
I'm on the hunt. And on another level you're going, I've got to show empathy and compassion to this person.
Well, I don't have
trust.
To. I just
well,
do, you know.
Well, it's good professional behavior as well, isn't it, at that point? You need to
–
she needs to trust you, right? I mean, it's important that she trusts you. I'm not saying you're being fake. I'm just saying you've got this sort of dichotomy in your head.
Mm-hmm.
How do you manage that inside yourself, you know? Because you are on an emotional journey with these people as well.
Indeed. Well, you can never become someone's friend.
Mm.
when they are your well, they're your subject really and your source, and you can't become their friend, you can't become their advocate. What was going on in my mind is constantly thinking, how is the audience going to perceive you? How am I weighing up what other people have told me about people's, you know, level of knowledge and what you're telling me? It's really the exact same principles as really apply in any story when you're interviewing someone. It just so happened that this one was such a sort of personal and terrifically disturbing subject matter. It was so nothing out of the ordinary was going on through my head. It was, I need to just figure out a way to tell your story really genuinely and properly, not hide your ugly bits, show your ugly bits, show the hostility, but also show too that you do have a heart. It was that, to be fair, really.
To be fair, yeah. Well, I think you're inscrupulously fair in it, yeah. One of the things that Expose does, and not dissimilar to Teacher's Pet, because they're both sort of in the same part of the world, the northern beaches of Sydney, they do – how much do you think Kelly Lane was a kind of a sense of product of her culture? I mean, not, you know, well, maybe we stop from being too much of a socio-demographer here. Yeah. But nonetheless, I mean, as you described her at the beginning, she is very much a product of this
golden
culture.
That's right. It's a good question because, look, for me, Kelly Lane is 99% a product of her upbringing, her culture, her environment, her surroundings, the expectations on her. And then I think, okay, I mean, I guess we're all a product of those same things. And then it comes down to personal responsibility for yourself and how you act and what you do and how you choose to conduct yourself and whether you choose to lie or not. And so that was a conflict for me as well. On the one hand, I knew she was a product of where she'd come from. And, you know, you heard in the program that for Kelly Lane, this girl, she was – her first sexual experience, she says, was a rape. She lost her virginity with a rape. There were – it was a constant fraternizing of older men and younger girls in these social circles in Manly, at the surf club and the sports club and at training and in water polo. It was an unhealthy environment. And the Teacher's Pet explored that really well. The exact same thing really was going on in Kelly Lane's world. It was inappropriate. And her friends told me exactly the same thing, that older guys, younger girls, totally out of your depth, a lot of drinking, and it was cool to sleep with a lot of people when you really weren't ready. So, and then on top of that, it was an environment where you don't talk about your weaknesses. You're expected to be a champion. You are a winner, Kelly Lane, and don't tell me about your problems. We don't have time for them. Get out there and win the next race or win the next match. And how you are perceived in community, Kelly, that it reflects on us, your mum and dad. You know, you are a good girl. So I don't really think Kelly Lane knew who she was. I don't know. She didn't have a strong sense of self-identity. She was such a people pleaser. And that was and when she was finally assessed, as you see in our program, the first time she's assessed by a forensic psychiatrist. Crazy when you think about it, considering she's sitting in jail for murder. Never been assessed by a forensic psychiatrist, but anyway. And that was the forensic psychiatrist came out and said exactly the same thing, a chronic people pleaser. And quite unusually, Kelly Lane she's incapable of criticizing men. She has been, and it's quite rare, she has been raised in a way that men are heroes and they aren't wrong. You don't criticize them and you do what they say. You never, ever dob them in. She had this complete inability to criticize men, which really surprised this psychiatrist. I don't think she sees it much. So all of our theories, you know, you theorize as a journalist, that they were... most of them were confirmed when the professionals went in to see her.
So did this – was it Dr. Buist, isn't it?
That's right, yes.
So
yes,
Dr. Buist changed your theories of Kelly?
She – no, she didn't change my theories, but she profoundly shocked me. Because I was at a point when Dr. Buist went to see Kelly Lane and I was at a point where I was actually, just to be completely honest, I was exhausted. I was really, really tired. And so was the rest of the team. And there'd been countless calls with Kelly Lane. I felt like I'd hit such a massive brick wall with her. I was lost in a sea of details and little facts and memories of hers. And I felt, I think probably like the police did, I was just out at sea with all of this stuff. And I needed a guide. because you can get lost in lots of different stories.
Sure.
And I needed a guide, and I was at a point where I was hoping Dr. Buist was going to go in and see Kelly. It was almost like I wanted a quick fix, and she was going to come out and say, here you go, Cara, I've got the answer for you. Mm. Kelly Lane she's delusional. Mm. She's a narcissist. She is a serial liar. She doesn't know the difference between truth and lies. I wanted her to just end it for me. But she came out and said the opposite.
She said she basically, Kelly Lane could be the woman sitting next to you on the bus.
That's right. And Tegan Lane could be alive. Kelly Lane could be innocent. And a man could be out there with her child. She wasn't a narcissist. She wasn't a pathological liar. She wasn't evil. She wasn't all these things that had been so widely and roundly reported of Kelly Lane. She wasn't any of these things, according to the expert. And it was sort of a bit of a relief, but also felt like tearing my hair out. Then who are we dealing with here? Are we dealing with an innocent person? Is she sitting in jail, an innocent person? And that was, you know, the door of possibility is then thrown wide open again.
Mm. You're not going to answer that question, are you? Maybe she is an innocent person.
I can, look, you know what? I can answer it, I guess. I can go creep towards it in a way that's the best way,
mm-hmm.
Which is really episode 3 was the episode for me where her innocence or guilt was sort of suspended, and the fairness of the process is what is at the heart of it here for me. Was that trial a fair one, and is it a safe conviction?
Mm-hmm.
Was it all above board in
there? Great questions, yeah.
And I think episode 3 showed that there was a lot going on behind the scenes that people didn't know about. There were witnesses that the jury didn't hear about. And to have these incredibly confessional interviews with the former homicide detective who led the investigation into Kelly Lane, for her to sit there and say, we were not ready to go to trial. Mm. Our investigation was not complete. We didn't even charge her with murder. We didn't have enough, we decided, the police.
DPP went.
The DPP did it a year later. To have those sorts of things and then to learn more about what was going on in the trial.
So is a fair action here, fair response to all that would be what, to release her and retrial?
Retrial's a leap. I think right at the moment there is now the formal application in with the Attorney General.
Yes.
And the Department of Justice for a judicial review of that trial, of the prosecutorial practices and the police practices that led to Kelly Lane being convicted. And I can't interfere with that process, but as I understand it, it is moving forward, and it is being seriously looked at whether there should be a judicial review. And, you know, then again, even after the series went to air, I reported a piece for 7:30. We had documents from really quite late into the murder trial where the prosecutor himself was fearing that the trial was going to be aborted because there were so many searches still outstanding for this child, school searches, all this sort of stuff.
Sure, sure.
Departmental searches. And you think, really? I mean, really, is this how a murder trial is run? Is this how it should be run?
Mm.
When people are not prepared, when so much hasn't been completed, when we're not hearing from crucial witnesses, what's going on here?
But there was so much pressure on the police and then the DPP to do something once the truth of the backstory was revealed.
The backstory in terms of her multiple pregnancies?
Yeah, yeah, maybe. Was there or not? I
think there were pressures. It was an interesting time for both the DPP and the Unsolved Homicide Squad. The DPP was under a lot of pressure financially then in New South Wales with the then AG Hatzitsagos, I think
yes, that's right.
And it was actually quite a public spat between the then DPP, Cowdery and Hatzitsagos. And so it wasn't a very good time for the DPP, and also over at Unsolved Homicide, I think they needed a win. They needed a conviction. They needed a prosecution too. So look, and maybe that was Kelly Lane. It was high profile. It was a big matter.
Hmm.
When you compare, though, the evidence, I guess, say with something like Lynn Dawson, which Hedley Thomas has so widely pointed out, it's this whole thing about what Mr. Cowdery was saying about nobody. You know, when you weigh up what cases are prosecuted and what aren't, it's just that comparison is astounding between the nobody for Lynn Dawson, that's why she could still be alive, the no body for Tegan Lane and Kelly Lane, that's why she's dead.
Well, that
how do you balance it?
Well, that brings up this the obvious question there, I suppose, is if Kelly Lane was Kel Lane, a philandering
yes,
dad,
yep.
Do you think, I mean, we're speculating at this point, which isn't what we should do as journalists, but do you think Kel Lane would be in Clink now?
Okay. Me, I believe that it was more believable, it seemed, and acceptable for those investigating and prosecuting Kelly Lane that a woman, a mother, would murder her child. It was more believable that would happen than it was for a man to take his child and raise it. Now, I don't know if that's inherent gender bias. I don't know what that is, but it was more believable that a woman had murdered the baby than it was the possibility that a dad would ever take a baby to raise it himself. How ridiculous. As if a man would ever do that. Really? I know countless men who are doing that right now.
Exactly.
Who are raising their children and the mothers aren't.
But that wasn't a prevailing idea.
No, it wasn't, it seems. But also Kelly had lied so much. But one of the really fascinating things too on that point, so much was made about Kelly Lane's promiscuity, basically that she was just a massive slut. And she was sleeping with everyone. So then that was part of her guilt too. She was so promiscuous. She just didn't care.
She was a Scarlet Woman at this point.
Indeed, yeah. And I was told that she was actually a police officer who used to work at Manly rang me after the series went to air because he was so compelled to tell me. He was saying, do you know what Kelly Lane was even known as in Manly? I said, no. Is this really material? Is this going to help me in my investigation? He said, yeah, it's important. She was known as the Manly Mattress. That says everything. It was just, yeah, it does say everything. How does that help?
Not necessarily about Kelly Lane.
No, it doesn't. But, so much was made about her promiscuity that I think that seemed to drown out a lot of more reasonable and rational talk. And, okay, if she's the Manly Mattress, then what of all the men who are lying on that mattress with her and having sex with her?
Indeed.
I know we got a bit lost there on the gender thing.
But just a couple more questions because we do have to wrap up. But where does this end for you? I mean, is there a logical conclusion of this story?
Well, there are only a...
There's only two ways, really, isn't there?
There is. There's only two ways, but there's sort of a finite amount of questions and holes that still need a plug in them and an answer to. And I think we've plugged a couple so far. There's still a few more, obviously, that we need to plug. But there is an end in sight, and I can't say what that is. I'd like to, but I can't say what that is.
Okay, but there will be a second season.
I can't answer that confidently either. But who knows what that second season will be on or about. But the Kelly Lane situation.
Yes, the situation. Okay, yeah.
It will be wrapped up. It will be resolved in, pardon me, the best way that it can be. But sometimes this stuff takes time, you know.
And you've got that time and you're willing
We've got the time. And the ABC is willing to give it the time too, which is the important thing. Sometimes you can't get everything you want straight away.
There's a song in that somewhere, isn't there? But yeah.
Yes, yeah, you can't always get what you want, I think it is.
Yeah, well, you often seem to, though.
No, I don't. I'm always complaining.
Are you?
Well,
I'm not saying that doesn't. Yeah, we want more.
I want
we always
more.
Want more.
I need more.
Yeah, of course, we
that's what it
more.
Is.
Yeah.
But no, I desperately want to get to the end of it, and I feel the weight of people's desire to resolve this situation. And in the end, really, there can't be anything. I mean, there can't be anything more serious and important than a 2-day-old baby. You know what?
Yeah.
Where is that girl? What happened to her?
So since the series aired, you've learnt a bit more information about these very promiscuous times. What's that?
We have. And this all really surprised us. What was so unbelievable about Kelly Lane was, you know, putting all her sexual history aside, was her capacity to conceal. And I don't think no one can really understand it. No one can empathise with it. How do you fall pregnant 3 times and conceal this and have these babies and give them away? I mean, it's positively freakish for so many people. They just don't understand it. And it was hard for us to understand. But obviously she was a young woman in a lot of distress, but still it was freakish. But since the series went to air, We were then receiving email after email after email after email of this confession, these confessional outpourings from Australian women who were writing, I have done exactly what Kelly Lane did. One woman wrote to us, she had three concealed pregnancies when she was 16, 17 and 19 years old.
Wow.
All of them concealed from her family, all of them she adopted out, and no one still knows to this day. Several other women writing the same thing. We've had people writing us to us saying, I am the result of a concealed pregnancy. I was that child, and I've recently found out.
And not so she, all the, from all over the country?
From all over the country.
Wow.
And not just one concealed pregnancy, but multiple.
Multiple concealed pregnancies.
Yeah. And for us it was, whoa, this happens. And the freakish element to Kelly really has really dissipated for me, this very hard to understand element, because you know, many other people have gone through this as well. And I wonder if the jury learnt more about that too, is what goes through my mind. Imagine if the jury heard about that as well, that this isn't, sure, it's certainly extreme behaviour, but it's not never before happened behaviour, and it's not murder behaviour, behaviour of murder, I think.
Well,
these are the things that run around in my head.
That goes back to
knowledge.
Anne Buist as well, right, that she could really be the woman sitting next to you on the bus.
Indeed, yeah.
Okay. On that note.
And is a mother innocent? Is she guilty?
On those notes, and those still burning questions.
But, before you finish.
Yes.
Putting that all aside, should Kelly Lane be sitting in Silverwater Women's Correctional Centre?
Answer your own question.
I think it needs to be answered by the Attorney General. I do. It's at that level now that that's where it needs to be answered and that's where it needs to be looked at. There are serious questions about what went on.
And will it be answered before the New South Wales state election? Unlikely, right?
Unsure. It took 2 years for a judicial review to be called for Kathleen Folbick. That sat on the AG's desk for 2 years. So that's why I said time, the tyranny of time. Maybe, who knows, maybe something here will happen a lot more quickly. A decision will be made either yay or nay a lot more quickly.
Okay.
I'd hope so.
Well, maybe you'll do something.
Indeed.
To prompt it.
That's right.
Indeed. Okay. Cara Meldrum-Hannah, thank you so much for being on Fourth Estate.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. You've been listening to The Fourth Estate, and if you make sure you subscribe to your favourite podcast app where you can listen to us at your leisure. And we'll be back soon. But in the meantime, follow us on Facebook or Twitter where our handle is Fourth Estate AU. My name is Peter Frey and thank you so much for listening.